This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And today, I have a guest who can tell you the story behind a lot of books. My guest is Zachary Leder, who has written The Life of Saul Bellow, To Fame and Fortune, 1915 to 1964. Hi, Zach. Are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Okay, well, this is fantastic. You've written, this is the first of your books about Saul Bellow.
Yes, it's the first volume of a two-volume biography.
So we're covering covering the first 49 years of Saul Bellow's life. So,
that's right.
You know, it is, of course, an amazing author, and he was the most acclaimed author, novelist in America, and of course he won the Nobel Prize in Literature and three National Book Awards and the Pulitzer Prize and so many other things. And your book about his life is really quite a feat. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. It's a long, a detailed book, but he led a rich and complicated life. He lived a long time. He published a lot of books, and he wrote a lot of books he didn't publish as well. And he was a busy person away from the desk as well as at the desk. He was not the kind of writer who spent his afternoons getting drunk, though he did say he spent his afternoons getting into trouble. What he did was he went out and met people. He exercised the power he had. He had a lot of power in literary and intellectual circles very responsibly. He made sure that everyone whose work he approved of got a fellowship or an editor or an assignment or a job at a college and so forth, and everybody he disapproved of didn't get these things. And he worked as an administrator in his department. I mean, he led a busy and complicated life, and his romantic life was pretty busy as well. He was married five times and had many serious affairs, as well as a number of.
So he had many things to do in the afternoon.
He had many things to do in the afternoon and the evening. Yeah.
Your book has been so well received, and you've gotten amazing reviews from people like Philip Roth. Of course, to have a review from him is fantastic, and of course, one of my favorite authors, James Shapiro, He just raves about your book. It's as I said, it's a big subject. You know, Saul Bellow is not in a way, he's sort of, to me, he's like asparagus. You know, some people think that asparagus is too fancy for them. That's it's a rich person's food, or it's for the elite. But actually, Saul Bellow is not for the elite. You know, he won a Nobel Prize for literature, and so many of the other people who've won Nobel Prizes, Sinclair Lewis or Pearl Buck, they seem just ordinary, or sort of not ordinary in the sense of you can just sort of jump into them. And people, when I've talked to people, they say, "Oh, Saul Bellow, wow, that's really hard." And I just wanted you to tell people, why should they read Saul Bellow?
He's a fantastic writer in a variety of ways. He has this power to see things perfectly, to capture both the natural world and human beings and their emotions and so forth in a startlingly lifelike way, which gives pleasure. I mean, imitation, well done, always gives pleasure, and he's a sort of famed noticer. So That's the first thing. He can capture the world absolutely beautifully and give pleasure and knowledge in doing so. I think another thing is that he evolved this amazing style, which allowed him to be true to a very mixed and not always or altogether elevated experience. He combined the life of the street. I mean, he grew up in a working class immigrant family with high culture. So it's true that you'll find allusions to philosophers and works of high literary merit, but they'll mingle with accounts of street crime and corrupt local politicians and baseball games and fashion and pool, all kinds of supposedly low life or low cultural pursuits. He has an enormous range, and he evolved a language that allowed him to give expression to all this experience, to go from hamburgers to Heraclides. I mean, he has the widest range imaginable, and one of the reasons that he's, for instance, so revered by writers from kind of more class-based society, British writers, for instance, like Ian McEwan and Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie, is he's unconstrained by those aspects of his background, which are considered impolite or lower class. He's proud of them. He has a sense of being true to his experience. And this language, where you find yourself at one moment talking about a philosopher and the next moment talking about cheap cars and so forth, is absolutely terrific. So that's the second thing. He can see the world perfectly. He's devised this fantastic language that allows all these things to be encompassed in a single style, this range of experience. The other thing is that he gets into words a gallery of personalities, people from his youth, who had hitherto not really been given to audiences who read serious literary fiction. I'm talking about the first and second generation immigrants, about whom he often writes in his novels, and he perfectly reproduces their voices and tells us what it's like to have been them, what their tensions were they operated under, and how they became American as well. And in the process, though some people call him a Jewish novelist, he resisted that. He resisted that title early on because he thought, by giving us an account of this Jewish American experience, he was giving us an account of American experience. I mean, as after all, to become an American is quite different from. I mean, to be an American is quite different from being, say, an Italian or an Englishman, where you have to have been born one of those. To be an American, you accede to or accept a series of propositions about how you should be governed and what human nature is, and so forth. And we watch as these immigrants from the 20s and 30s go through this process. So it's about becoming an American as well as the experience of a Jewish American. Anyway, those three things, he tells us all about the experience of second generation Americans. He has this fantastic language he's evolved, and he can see things absolutely perfectly.
You know, when you read him, it's sometimes the way the words flow is really quite amazing. It's you just have to sort of be in awe of how he is able to. I know it seems so easy, and of course I know that he worked very hard to make it look that way. You know, it's just like, you know, a good actor, the plays a role and looks so easy, but there's a lot that goes behind it. And I know he worked very hard to get that voice of his. Now his first two books, I know that they were not great successes. And his third book, let's talk about his third book and what happened when that exploded onto the scene.
Yeah, his first two novels were written in 1944. That's Dangling Man. In 1947, he wrote second volume, The Victim. And these novels, when you say they didn't do very well, they didn't sell very well. But they were critically acclaimed. They got him very important and influential critical supporters. Edmund Wilson, who at that time was the sort of best-known non-academic critic, the sort of New Yorker book reviewer, and Lionel Trilling, who was probably the most important academic literary critic of the age. Both of them became great fans of Bellow's writing. But he had no larger commercial success. And these two early novels, Dangling Man and The Victim, were written to what he called a Flaubertian standard. I mean, he was he worked very hard to learn how to write a sort of pure, elevated, literary English. I mean, he had to work out from under a family whose first language was Russian and languages were Russian and Yiddish. And he felt very proud of himself that he'd done it, but he also felt he wasn't being true to himself because he wasn't finding a way to give voice to his everyday experience from his family, from the neighborhoods in which he grew up. Anyway, he won a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1948 and went to Paris with it. And the third novel he was working on was this very depressing novel, and he just couldn't. He was low. He didn't actually like Paris very much. It was very cold and grisly, and sort of echoes of the war were still there for him. He was as depressed as the novel he was writing. And he tells this wonderful story about a kind of a moment of epiphany. He was walking from his apartment to the place where he worked, the little writing room he'd rented in a hotel. And it was one of the mornings in which the sewers were being cleaned, the waters were sluicing down the sidewalk and the gutters. It was a sunny day, and the sun was glittering off the water, and he thought to himself, why can't I be as free in my movements as this water with the sun shining on it? Why am I so constrained, and why am I writing this depressing novel? It's going to depress everyone else. It's already depressed me. And immediately, suddenly, into his head came the thought of a childhood friend of his named Charlie August, with whom he used to play checkers. And Charlie August was a kind of open, free, self-confident young man who used to say, "I got a scheme," when he talked about the plans he had to win his in the checkers game. And he said immediately the first line of The Adventures of Augie Marsh, I'm an American, Chicago born, and so forth, came into his head. And he went back to his writing room, and he started writing The Adventures of Augie Marsh, which he said came to him in buckets. And it was not written in the style of the first two novels. It was written in this freewheel. I go at things freestyle, Augie says, in this freewheeling manner. Bang! He said it came to him in buckets. He was fantastically unconstrained in his writing and fluent as the water shining in the pavement along the pavement and sidewalks in Paris. And he wrote this enormous great novel, The Adventures of Augie Marsh. Almost all of it was written in. Away from America, and it's all about this young American boy who he hadn't seen in 30 years, and whose life he sort of imagined, or he imagines a life for this old friend, this friend of his from childhood, and it went on and won the National Book Award, and it began to give him a commercial as well as a critical success. It's really the novel in which he found his voice, though he later claimed that that he sort of had gone too far and he should have revised it more than he did. when someone asked him what the Adventures of Augie March was about, he said, well, it's about 200 pages too long. He did refine this later on. He was a very instinctive writer, but he did also refine the things he wrote, worked very hard on the editing as he progressed. So that was the big breakthrough novel early on.
Now, of course, as you're talking, one right away realizes that you know Saul Bellow very well. And, you know, as part of your research, I know that you have done an amazing amount of research and sort of walked in his shoes and really, you know, as a writer, just gone way beyond what most biographers would go.
Well, I don't know about the most biographers, but I had written I was a bog standard, as they say in England, academic. I was a specialist in romantic poetry. I'd written books about Blake and Wordsworth and so forth. And then for a variety of reasons, I all of a sudden started writing. I was asked to write a biography of Kingsley Amis. I was a friend of his son, Martin. And I wrote this biography of Kingsley Amis. And Kingsley Amis is the most English of novelists. And you know, in order to gain the trust of his extremely English friends and relatives and so forth, I had to learn everything I could about the culture. And when I finally finished, I edited Amis's letters, and then I wrote his biography. I thought it's time to do an American, something about an American. I am an American. I grew up in California until I was 14 when my family moved to England. I go back to America every year, but I've been living in England for over 40 years. Anyway, so I thought, well, what's a good American subject? And I thought originally I'd edited the letters of Norman Mailer. But I found out that someone else was editing them, and Mailer's agent said he was coming to London. Let's talk about it. And I looked up the agent's author list, and there was Saul Bellow. And I thought, well, I'll edit the letters of Saul Bellow. And I met this agent, and the agent said, well, have you any ideas? And I said, well, what about Saul Bellow? He said, that's a great idea. I'm going to meet with the people who advise the executor, and I'm sure they'll think it's a great idea. And then he took me to dinner. And it turned out over the course of the dinner that he thought I was talking about writing a biography of Saul Bellow, and all the time I thought we were talking about editing Saul Bellow's letters, which it turned out were already going to be edited by someone else, a very nice man named Benjamin Taylor. So it's not as though I came to Saul Bellow because I had a lifelong and burning interest in him. I came to Saul Bellow because he was a really great writer, and I wanted to write about an American writer in some way, or think about an American writer. And this was in 2008, and I immediately started reading everything he wrote. And then I was offered the opportunity to teach at the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, where he taught for over 30 years. I taught a course on Bellow's novels in the winter of 2008, and completely fortuitously, the housing person at the University of Chicago found my wife and I an apartment in the same building that Bellow had lived in for a number of years, in an apartment just below the one he had lived in. So that I found that I was following in his footsteps quite inadvertently. I mean, I would look out my window and see the view he saw. It was actually a view of the Chicago Lab School, and you could see the playing fields where apparently Sasha and Malia Obama were playing soccer. Anyway, I never saw them, but I'd look out to see what the weather was, and I'd walk to work at the Committee on Social Thought. Is exactly his walk. So you know, this notion that a biographer should follow in the footsteps of his or her subject, even when the subject is, you know, from the 19th century and so forth, it doesn't make any sense. I hadn't set out to do this, but I found myself doing it, and
Well, it was fate. Something in the cards.
I just wanted to say that Bella was famous very early, and he had secretaries, and they kept all his papers. The reason I had to go to Chicago was there are 350 boxes of Bella's papers at the library, and I had to go through those as well. So as I was following in his footsteps, I was reading the things that he both wrote and received from others.
Zach, I have to take a quick commercial break, sure. And we'll be right back, and I want to talk more about the University of Chicago and all of your research.
Sure. Thanks.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345. Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. On January 30th, when best-selling author Tim Dorsey will be signing autographs of his latest adventure, Coconut Cowboy. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing, our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a million-dollar view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, one of the greatest biographers, I think, of all time, because he's done an amazing amount of research. And not since I read Nancy Milford's book about Zelda have I been so impressed with a book. And this is Zachary Leader. We're talking, he's in England, and we're talking about the life of Saul Bellow, to fame and fortune, 1915 to 1964. And of course, those are the first 49 years of Bellow's life. Hi, Zach. Let's talk about a little bit more about both the research that you did and just about Bello in general. You know, I was a few months ago, I interviewed one of his editors, Bina Kemlani.
Mm-hmm.
And she was delightful, and she told me so many fun, you know, and interesting stories about him. Now, she was telling me that she read Saul Bellow when she was 8 years old, which was a little early. She must have been a very precocious child. So you didn't come to Saul Bellow as a young person. You had read him when you were very young.
Well, I think, you know, like most people, the first Saul Bellow novel I read was the shortest, Seize the Day. And then I was, when I was in last year or so of high school and then on into college, I read the other short ones, the first two, The Victim and Dangling Man. But then I started reading Bellow's novels as they came out, which brought me back to the ones that I'd missed, Augie March and the longer ones, and Henderson, the Rain King, and Herzog, and so forth. And I mean, he was one of the handful of novelists whose novels I always read when they came out. I never actually, I never fairly or properly met him. I once shook his hand and listened to him at a party in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1972. But for the life of me, I can't remember a word he said. He looked very angry and very bored, and it's only now that I realize why he should have looked that way, given what was happening in his life in 1972. I certainly didn't start reading him when I was eight. I was reading the Hardy Boys and science fiction.
Exactly. Now, you know, we talked a little bit. One of the things that, of course, as you said, he helped the people he liked and he didn't help the people he didn't like. And one of the people that he didn't like, of course, was one of his ex-wives, who featured very strongly in his work.
Yeah. He had five wives, and only the last one escaped thinly disguised fictionalization in his novels in a negative fashion. The fifth wife is depicted wonderfully and with wonderful compliments in the last of his novels, Ravelstein. But his second wife, Sandra or Sasha Chakbasov, who he married when she was very young, they split up acrimoniously. I mean, they split up because she was having an affair with the man who was pretending to be Bellow's best friend, and who Bellow thought was at least a very close friend. And when Bellow discovered it, I mean, he went haywire for a while, but then immediately put it to literary use and within this novel, Herzog, which he began in 1960-61, and which came out in 1964, and which really made him famous in a sort of Time magazine way, as opposed to in a partisan review or a New York Review of Books way. I mean, made him a kind of international celebrity. I mean, it was on the bestseller list for many, many weeks. It sold 140,000 copies in hardback very quickly and so forth. And at the heart of this novel is a rather one-sided account of the betrayal he suffered with from his second wife and the man who he thought was a very close friend. Anybody who knew the Bellows would have known that this was a sort of skewered kind of revenge portrayal of his wife Sasha, who I got to know and interviewed a number of times, and of course he had his reasons for depicting her the way he did, and in the novel Herzog, she's not called Sasha, she's called Maddie, and she's a fictional character, not a real life person. But I mean, the tricky business about drawing on real life people, if you're a novelist like Saul Bellow, is he, as I said at the beginning, he can so perfectly describe a thing that when he then goes to describe a person whose qualities and characteristics make you immediately think, oh, yeah, that's his wife or that's this other person, you can't help but entertain the suspicion that he's seeing right into them and showing us their true nature. This is a kind of danger of being so perfect a noticer. Anyway, Sasha Chalk-Bossoff, Sasha Bellow, partly at the instigation of her son and partly through the interviews we had, decided to write out a memoir, which would a kind of account of her life, which she gave to her copy she gave to Adam Bellow, her son, and a copy she gave to me, and I was able to draw on it to give a fuller account of the real life ground out of which the novel grew. It's the novel is not the same as real life, but it grew out of real life situation. And there are lots of dimensions of the story, of the real life story, that don't find their way into the novel.
So how many of the wives did you interview?
Well, two of Bellow's five wives had died when I started in 2008. His first wife, Anita, and his third wife, Susan. And I was not able to interview them. But I did interview Sasha, the second wife, and Alexandra, the fourth wife, and Janice, the fifth wife and the executor of the estate. Alexandra and Janice had not talked to previous biographers, and Sasha had talked to previous biographers but had not given them the sort of information I gathered I was able to draw on from the memoir. They all were very understandably wary at first, but then very forthcoming. I met sort of many hours of tapes of interviews with them. And of the two wives who had died before I began work, Anita's son, Gregory, did eventually talk to me. There was some resistance at first because he was writing a memoir of his father at the time, and he didn't really want to talk until after it became clear the memoir was coming out before my book and so forth. And also, he felt very strongly that he had suffered from the intrusion of biographers in his life, and that somehow or other, all the people who really admired Bellow, all the men who admired Bellow and wanted to write about him, saw themselves in the position of sons, and he was the actual son, and what were these people doing getting in the way? But I sort of made it clear that I wasn't that kind of a fan or obsessive admirer. I had no desire to be Saul Bellow's son, nor could I be, since he was no longer alive. And I think eventually I gained his trust. And Susan's son, Daniel, was very forthcoming. They're all very intelligent. Bellow had three sons from three different wives, each from a different mother, a different wife. And then at the very end of his life, when he was 85, he had a daughter with Janice, the fifth wife. They were all very helpful after initial wariness.
Well, I think that it was it was fate that led you to work on the life of Saul Bellow, and it's certainly a rich story. It's so vast, and I can see why it's going to be in two volumes. And this, of course, is the first 49 years of his life. And as I said, I think that, there was, among a lot of people, there was the idea that he was not reachable, that he was not
accessible as
other authors. But I think that it is when you read his work and you read the way that he played with words and described things, and it is really fantastic. And what would you recommend as the first book people should read when they're want to get into
Bob? I do have a recommendation about this when people ask me this. There's a Penguin paperback called The Collected Stories, and Bellows' stories, he wrote long stories, at least two of them are of novella length, but it's some of his writing at its best. And if you read stories in the Penguin paperback, like The Old System, or Something to Remember Me By, or A Silver Dish, if you read these stories and aren't moved or pleased or in love with the writing, then you probably aren't going to like Saul Bellow. But my bet is that you'd like those stories. They're absolutely terrific. And that would lead you then on more confidently to the longer novels. Among the novels, I think the funniest is Hubbell's Gift. Probably the most influential.
Just quickly tell people about this book, because this is it's a very funny book.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely a terrific account of a man in some ways, Charlie Citrine, very much like Bellow, who gets involved. It's a fantastical plot with a gangster named Cantabile, he knows all about low-life Chicago and gangster Chicago and the immigrant neighborhoods he grew up in, but he also writes about the University of Chicago and the high life. His protagonist, Charlie Citrine, rather like him, moves in very exalted circles, having come from the kind of working-class background he came from, and the novel is full of absolutely terrific characters. Bellow loved larger-than-life figures, and he could produce them wonderfully. The Humboldt of the title, on Humboldt Fleischer, is based on the poet Delmore Schwartz, a sort of fantastically gifted and neurotic poet who he'd met when they were both teaching at Princeton. And he's an amazing and funny and energetic and poignant character as well. And his fate and Citrine's are in some ways reflections of Delmore Schwartz's and Bellow's experience. But the novel's very jazzy and racy and full of funny as well as moving scenes. So it's the novel I'd recommend after you'd had a go at the short stories.
Well, I agree. It is the perfect one to really jump into. And I want to thank you so much today for joining me today. It's just been really great to talk to you. I know that how many years is it going to take you to come out with the second book?
Well, I'm a little bit more than halfway through the second volume, and I think it'll take me a year or so.
Well, that's...
Then it has to be produced.
Oh, one thing I wanted to ask, is it true, what were Saul Bellow's last words?
I don't know, I haven't got there yet.
Okay, we haven't got there. Okay, well...
Yeah, there's some controversy.
I'm not sure. That's what I want you to clear up, because people have said different things, and I'm waiting for the definitive answer to that. So when you finish your book, the second volume of this fantastic work that you're doing on Saul Bellow, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again. And meanwhile, I want to tell everyone that they can get this book. It is an amazing work. And so it's available, I know, on Amazon and all the places that you can get books. So thank you so much, Zachary Leder, for joining me today from England.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. On January 30th, when best-selling author Tim Dorsey will be signing autographs of his latest adventure, Coconut Cowboy. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back. It was great fun to talk to Zach Leader, and I know in about a year and a half or 2 years, I'll have him back. And if you haven't dipped your toe into Saul Bellow, it's a good time to do it. Just go online. You can start with his first books, or with, as Zach Leader suggested, start with the short stories. They are wonderful, and you will... I think you will find yourself a big fan of Saul Bellow. Now, just a few things I want to talk about today before I finish up. Big Ed, are you in the control room there? You're not? Yeah? Say hi.
I am here.
Okay. Tell me, do you like to dance? Are you a dancer?
I'm not much of a dancer, if that's answer your
but
question.
But you like to dance, I bet. And does your wife like to dance?
Without me, sure.
No, I bet she likes to dance. You know, that's one of the things I've, having lived in Houston for many years, of course, we had, everybody was dancing in Houston. There were so many places to go dancing. And there just are not a lot of places around here in Clearwater, St. Petersburg area, to go dancing. So it was so wonderful when I discovered this place called Miami Avenue Wine Bar. And it's just off of Gulf Boulevard in Indian Rocks Beach. It's a fantastic place. And Ed, I'm telling you, plan for Valentine's Day and take your wife dancing, because at the wine bar, it's a wonderful atmosphere. It's cozy. It's welcoming. And you can dance. They have live music on Friday and Saturday nights. And it's just a fun place to go. The wines are all natural wines, you know, no preservatives, which everybody looks for nowadays, and they're really great. And the entire atmosphere is just fantastic. And I'm hoping to encourage writers, if you're looking for a place for to hold an event, like a book signing, your book launch, it's a great place to bring in a crowd of people. It's a very There's lots of space there. It's beautifully decorated, and just it's a charming place and a very welcoming place. And so to any writer who's going to have a book, a launch there, I'm going to offer a $50 gift certificate to any writer who has a book launch at the Miami Avenue Wine Bar in Indian Rocks Beach, because it'll be a lot of fun, and I will join you. If you have a book launch with wine, I will join you, and I'm sure you'll get other people to join in too, because it's lots of fun. And so that's my offer to anybody who wants to have a book launch at the wine bar. Now, I also want to talk about, I had a guest on a few weeks ago, Irene Goodman, and I want to talk again because on the first of every month, she puts up an auction on eBay for a critique. Now, the money all goes to charity, primarily to Hope for Vision or Foundation for Fighting Blindness. And as writers and people who love to read books, you can imagine how terrible it is to go blind. And so these groups are working to solve all the different problems, particularly childhood blindness, which is so devastating. So Irene Goodman is really, she is the top literary agent in New York. She's been in the business for 30 years. She's been the main speaker at so many of the major writing conferences. Last year, she was the keynote speaker at the San Francisco Writers Conference. And her critiques are worth the money. And when you know also that the money, you know, when it's always difficult, you can't just, you know, have your work critiqued by somebody that you pick up off the net. It doesn't work. But I'm telling you, when Irene Goodman reads your work and gives you a critique, it's worth the money, because she knows what makes a bestseller. She knows what makes an author a valuable commodity. So her critiques are excellent. All of the people who have had them are amazed at how helpful they are. They're not just, you know, fluff. She goes into detail about why, you know, what you've done about the work, what it might need, the good points and the bad points, but in a very gentle and constructive way. And the auctions take place at the beginning of each month. There are two auctions, and you can just go to her webpage, which is irenegoodman.com. And right on the front page, they have there the information that you need to do. So I highly suggest it. Each critique, when you get it back, is like 3 pages and quite detailed, telling you what you need to do. And, of course, you know, there is no promise or anything that she would ever represent you. But you never know. And the most important thing is she will help you to focus your energy in the right direction and offer suggestions on which way you should go. So please think about it. And the last few auctions have gone for, I think, $500, something like that. And it's worth it to get the feedback from Irene Goodman. If you go to her webpage, what you'll see is that I have interviewed quite a few of her best-selling authors, and if you go to her webpage, you'll see that she has just so many of the great authors have been represented by her company. She has 6 agents, and so go to her webpage, irenegoodman.com. And I want to also talk briefly. I've got several guests coming up. I have Mike Resnick coming up on February 2nd. If you are into sci-fi, if you want to write sci-fi, if you want to read the best sci-fi, then you have to read Mike Resnick. I think he's won more prizes for his sci-fi work than any other author. I mean, he is quite amazing. And if you haven't read him, you really do have to, because his writing is so good and so delightful. He has a fantastic mind, and I just, you know, it's a joy to read his books when you're looking for sort of inspiration. And you want to know if you're on the right track when it comes to sci-fi, I suggest you reach for Mike Resnick, and you'll find out that, you know, you'll say to yourself, wow, this is not just, it's not just sci-fi, because it's he lifts it to a new level of accomplishment. So he's going to be on February 2nd. On January 28th, I have, it's going to be fun, because I have a local author, but a very well-known local author, and that is Tim Dorsey. He is going to be at Haslam's for a book signing. So he's going to be on my program on Thursday, and then on the weekend he's going to be at Haslam's for a book signing. And if you haven't read Tim Dorsey's books, you've really missed something. His character is... it's hard to describe. His character's name is Serge Storm, and he and his sidekick go on all sorts of adventures throughout Florida. And in this latest book called Coconut Cowboy, they sort of channel their inner Easy Rider mind, their adventures are hilarious, and also, there's a lot of action and adventure, and they all take place here in Florida. And Tim Dorsey, who used to work for the Tampa Tribune, is a great lover of Florida trivia, and so the books are all sort of mixed up with trivia and murder and sex, and it's just quite amazing. Now, this book comes out, is released on the 28th, which is the day he's going to be on the program. And if you haven't read any of his books, I suggest you go back, go to Amazon and get Orange Crush. In this political season, it has to be one of the funniest books about politics. Again, it's one of the, in the series of Serge Storm mysteries, but it's so hilarious. It's about the governor of Florida who is called up to active duty. And you'll laugh your head off when you read that. So anyway, have a great week. This is Patsy with a Z. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. And have a great week. Bye.